listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and current lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's show intro was OCM by Susan Aglukarg. Unceded Airwaves broadcasts every week from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Autumn Chanel Vilji, I'm Treaty 11 Gwich'in and Inuvialuit on my mother's side. I was born and raised on the Treaty 6 territory of the Cree, Métis, Nakota Sioux, and Soto peoples. And I acknowledge that I'm an uninvited guest on the unceded Coast Salish lands, and I'm so grateful to be here.
My name is Josh Kiyoki, and I'm from the Attawapiskat First Nation. I'm also a settler Canadian and an uninvited guest on unceded Musqueam territory as I study here at UBC.
Perfect. We want to thank our sponsors, Decolonizing Water and NORAD Electric. You're listening to Season 3, Episode 6 of Unceded Airwaves. Today, we will be talking to Duncan McHugh about his newly released book, The Shoeboy, his experiences on the land when he was quite young, his sustainability, and then finally, his experience as an Indigenous journalist. And then we will be having a roundtable discussion about the perception of indigeneity, what it means to us to be Native, and then our experiences not being Native enough. You might find this topic hits close to home for you. Feel free to keep listening or not. But before we get into it, let's set our intention for the day. We are the Indigenous Radio Collective. Every week we discuss Indigenous issues, current events, and entertainment. We are a collective of Indigenous and non-Indigenous students who use our weekly airtime for our own self-representation.
We strive to center Indigenous voices on our show and to build narratives that empower Indigenous people. Unceded Airwaves is our opportunity to share and define the diversity of our cultures and highlight some influential Indigenous people.
If you can relate to the goals of the show and are wondering how to get involved, please reach out. You can always reach us on social media. We have Facebook and Twitter. If you have a voice for decolonization, then we want to hear from you.
Everyone is welcome, and there is no experience necessary. Our weekly meeting is going to be every Monday at 4 p.m., at CITR on the lower level of the Nest. If you want to get involved but don't want to be on air, there are plenty of other ways to participate in this collective.
You can follow Unceded Airwaves on Facebook and Twitter. If you are aware of a great Indigenous artist, send us a tweet using the hashtag Unceded Music, or send us a Facebook message at Unceded Airwaves, and we will do our best to put it on air. And if we play a song that you send us, we will even give you a shout out.
We're always looking to hear from our listeners about what you're up to, so let us know about any Indigenous artists that you're into right now and what events you're attending or promoting. As always, we'll post a link to the podcast of this episode after the show. We'll have our weekly unceded events listing to share a little bit later.
Dressmaker, I'm singing at the hall. Shade of blue with a ribbon at the hem. Oh, hit a sweet and gentle start. And maybe he'll remember me, 'twas not so long ago. I need his sweet and gentle smile. Make it a soulful shade of blue.
Ever used or wanted to use a community lending library, collective workshop, or bike co-op? Come out to Making Space, Questioning Power and Privilege in Makerspaces on Wednesday, November 29th in the Mount Pleasant Neighborhood House from 5 to 8 p.m. to examine how power and privilege shows up in makerspaces and explore strategies that support more inclusive and equitable initiatives. Go to diversityandmakerspaces.eventbrite.ca to register for this event, and there'll be free food.
The Crane Library is looking for student volunteers to record textbooks for those who cannot use print at the university. If you are a UBC student who is computer literate with an ability to read university material aloud and you have a willingness to learn new techniques, we ask for a two-hour commitment once a week. For additional information and to set up an audition, call 604-822-6114 or email crane.volunteer@ubc.ca.
The song you just heard was Soulful Shade of Blue by Buffy St. Marie. Earlier this week, I sat down with Duncan McHugh to discuss his newly released novella, his on-the-land experiences, and his personal sustainability standards, and how he feels as an Indigenous journalist. Here is what he had to say.
My name's Duncan McHugh. I'm a host with CBC Radio, a show called Cross Country Checkup. I also work with CBC The National. And I'm Anishinaabe from the Chippewas of Georgina Island First Nation.
That's fantastic. What are you doing here at UBC?
I have had the pleasure of being invited here to talk about a book I wrote called The Shoe Boy, which came out last year. And it's a short novella, we call it. It's nonfiction and an account of 5 months that I spent on a trap line in northern Quebec, James Bay, when I was 17 years old.
That's really cool. Can you tell us a little bit about your recently released novella or nonvella?
Yeah, I had this really incredible, unfortunate experience when I was 17 years old. I graduated from high school, and my father asked me if I would be interested in spending time on a trap line rather than going off to university. We had been living in James Bay on the Quebec side amongst the Cree people. So I'm Ojibwe,
yeah.
But we had been living amongst the Cree for 5 or 6 years.
Huh.
And my father asked if I wanted to go out on the land. And I always, from the first time that we moved up to James Bay, I had loved hunting. I'd gone goose hunting, ptarmigan hunting, that kind of thing. But the opportunity to spend 5 months living with a Cree family out in the bush and really living on the land, it was an amazing opportunity. So I decided to take him up on that, and so I lived with a family. Robbie Matthews Sr. was the elder, his wife Sally, and his three youngest sons, Adrian, Bruce, and Matthew, and we lived way out in the bush. Only saw a supply plane twice, and weren't really in contact with the outside world except through our CB radio.
So that was the basis for your novella. What was the process like in writing it?
It was interesting because I was writing it as a 40-something adult, thinking back on my life, this experience when I was 17.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a search and rescue mission. I went back and tried to find my journal, and I did from that time, and I had written almost nothing. That whole 5 months, I had written very little. I went back and decided to try to recover these memories. What got me started was I was taking a creative writing class at Stanford University, and we had an assignment where I was asked to name a teacher, mm-hmm. one of the most influential teachers in my life. And my answer was this Cree elder, Robbie Matthews Sr. I think a lot of people think of their elementary or secondary or maybe their university professors. But I thought about Robbie Matthew. And so the book was really an attempt to try to figure out what Robbie had taught me at this really formative period in my life when I was 17 years old.
That's really neat. Do you have a specific memory that you can recall from when you were that young?
There were so many. I mean, what
a favorite one, maybe?
I think one of the things that really stuck out for me were those experiences that I had on the land. So we were there to hunt and trap. We were trapping beaver, otter, muskrat. Those we were there to gather those furs so that Robbie could support his family. But we were living off what we ate, and so we were hunting small game, whether it was grouse or ptarmigan, rabbit, occasionally bigger game like caribou, and then one day a bear.
Really?
Yeah, the day with the bear was quite something.
Yeah.
We were at our camp. It was it was early November, and the bears really were by that point typically hibernating. The ice had started to form on the lake. And all of a sudden, a bear came around the corner.
Oh, wow.
And we all we couldn't believe it. And Robbie ended up shooting the bear with a .22 Magnum, which is not a powerful enough gun typically to take down a bear. I recount that story, and I won't go into the whole detail about what ended up happening with the bear. But, I mean, it was powerful to see Robbie's connection with the bear and his explanation for why that bear came to us was really that he had this personal connection with the animal, and that he had to offer the animal, the bear, respect. And so I remember when we were done and we brought the bear back, couple of things. I mean, how eerie it was once we had taken all the fat off the animal and taken the fur off, how much a bear looks like a human being. That was quite something. And then Robbie coming out and bringing the bones to me and saying, hang the bones out on the tree, on the trees and the various parts around the camp. And that was a way of showing respect to the bear and thanking the bear for the gift that he'd given us, his life.
That's really neat. And I know that also in Cree tradition, bears are really important animals.
Powerful animals.
Yeah.
Amongst a lot of indigenous groups.
Yeah.
And again, when you see a bear, you realize just, you know, there are so many connections to humans, and I think that's why so many indigenous groups honor bears.
And then, so you chose that elder as the person who was one of your most influential teachers. Do you still recall teachings from that time in your life where they stuck with you? And
it was an incredibly formative period for me because I'm Ojibwe, but I'm also the term back in the day was half breed.
Yeah,
that's not a politically correct term anymore. But my mom is white; she's of Scottish and German heritage. My dad is Ojibwe, and so as a teenager, I was really wrestling with who I was as an Indian,
mm-hmm.
As a young indigenous male.
Yeah,
and that going out in the bush with Robbie and his family in this very traditional Cree lifestyle, living off of the land where they spoke Cree as their first language, where they were very, very in touch with Robbie's hunting territory,
mm-hmm.
with the animals, with the cycles of nature. It helped me a lot formulate who I was as a young indigenous man, and gave me but it was challenging because I was really, I felt at the time that I wasn't a very good Indian. I wasn't a good hunter.
Yeah.
I was a terrible hunter. I didn't have the skills that most Cree youth would take for granted. I was an urban Ojibwe kid who was suddenly thrust into this environment where I didn't have the skills that I needed to survive on the land. And so that was really tough for me as a young teenager when you're trying to build self-confidence, to be thinking about yourself and say, man, I'm a lousy Indian. I don't know how to do this stuff.
Yeah.
So all of that was really, it was hard. It was difficult for me, but it was also incredibly formative. And I think it helped make me the proud Indigenous man that I am today.
That's really neat. And then how was it being an Ojibwe person, getting all of those Cree teachings? So
way back, the Ojibwe and the Cree are neighboring nations.
Yeah.
And have kind of an interesting relationship. There were times that we squabbled and there were wars between the Ojibwe and the Cree, but also lived very similar lifestyles. And
yeah.
Ojibwe and Cree are very similar languages. So lots of similarities, kind of like the Italian and the French, I suppose, maybe it would be a way to explain it.
Lots of teaching parallels.
Yeah. But for me, the biggest hardship for me was that I didn't speak Cree. I was an Ojibwe and I was an English language speaker on top of that. And so that put me in kind of a bubble almost, in my own little language bubble that was difficult to overcome. But the similarities and parallel between Cree traditional lifestyle and Ojibwe traditional lifestyle they're very, very complementary.
Yeah.
And so I'm just so thankful that the Cree families welcome me into their hunting camps and their lives.
They're really lovely. I grew up on Cree territory, but I'm Gwich'in from Treaty 11, and they're just so welcoming. It was lovely. And then how does your book maintain sustainability standards?
I think there are some incredibly powerful lessons that contemporary society can learn from hunters and trappers.
Oh,
We know that hunting and trapping is a lifestyle that's incredibly hard to maintain financially, both for Indigenous and non-Indigenous trappers. The fur industry and the fur business is, it's very difficult to be able to support a family by living off the land now. One of the incredible things that the Cree did when they were faced with the onslaught of the James Bay Hydro-Québec project in the 1970s and ended up signing the James Bay Agreement, which is a modern-day treaty, they wanted to ensure that the Cree families who wanted to continue to live that lifestyle had that opportunity. And so they created what's called a guaranteed income support for Cree trappers. And so every man, woman, and child that lives out on the land gets between $50 and $70 a day, which helps supplement their income. I think what we in urban society, contemporary 2017, we seem so disconnected from that lifestyle, living on the land, hunting animals that come onto your table every night. But I think the most powerful thing that we can and should learn from hunters and trappers is that notion of respect. In the Cree worldview, the hunter really doesn't place himself at the top of the hierarchy and as the harvester, if you will, who's entitled to harvest all of the fruits of the land. The hunter is very much part of a circle, and the animals are part of the circle, and the plants are part of the circle, and all of the gifts that the land gives Iyo-Itchi in this particular case, all of those gifts, if they're not respected, if the hunter doesn't pay back and give reciprocal offerings to animals and land, then those gifts won't come to the hunter. And I think that lesson, that teaching, that worldview is incredibly important and can be transported into urban Vancouver in 2017.
Yeah, that's true. That's a circle of life. And then how do you maintain sustainability standards as a human being? Is there something that you...
David Suzuki said it 20, 30 years ago, the personal is political in many ways. And so God help me, I do my best to not get paper coffee cups. I mean, that's my real, I can't stand all those paper coffee cups going into the waste basket. But I do my best to live in as an environmental a fashion as one can in a city. But I do think that it's important that we bring to light, and I have in my journalism, whether it's on CBC Radio or on the national on CBC, I have tried to bring more awareness to stories about climate change. It can be a mind-boggling topic for a lot of people. What can I do when the polar bears are losing their habitat? What can I do? These are things that only governments can change.
Yeah.
Well, I think the reality is that people need to change, mm-hmm. and we need to change our individual lifestyles. Cities can change, and we can see that here in Vancouver, that this is a city that is leading the way in at least trying to make some difference when it comes to whether it's electric vehicles or changing building codes, that cities and small-scale universities can make a difference and make a change when it comes to climate change, and that's all. The personal is political.
And then, in your opinion, how is sustainability an Indigenous issue?
Well, I mean, I think Robbie Matthews Sr. would probably laugh at the idea and the word of sustainability.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there is a word in Cree that would necessarily, I mean, my knowledge of Cree isn't strong enough to give you what his word would be. But it's the notion of sustainability is built into the traditional lifestyle of our peoples. And not just the Cree, but the Musqueam here, the Gwich'in, all of our teachings when it comes to living off the land were very much about maintaining and being able to pass on the gifts of the land to the next generation. Mm-hmm. I do think that notion of sustainability in an Indigenous context can often be oversimplified to assume that First Nations people, Indigenous people, are the original environmentalists and tree huggers, and that's not necessarily the case. For our ancestors, what was important was passing on their teachings to the next generation. And for this generation of Indigenous people, passing on the teachings and being connected to the land and being connected to our territory in some cases might mean copper mines. It might mean pipelines. It might mean clear-cutting forest. Those are decisions that self-determining nations need to make mm-hmm. about continuing their connection to the land. But I do think that First Nations are very cognizant of what our ancestors passed on to us and try to make those decisions, those business decisions, when they make them in a sustainable way.
How do you reconcile the expectation to be sustainable as an Indigenous person with your choice to live sustainably? I find that there's always a predisposed expectation where people are just assume that you have to be more sustainable because you're an Indigenous person.
Well, so that goes to the point that I'm talking about, yeah. in terms of people's understanding non-Indigenous people's understanding of Indigenous people, mm-hmm. and what I think is important for people to recognize, and particularly when it comes to this conversation of sustainability. Mm-hmm. Is that trope and stereotype of Native as environmentalist mm-hmm. has been around for a while.
Yeah.
You know, the hippies loved it in the 60s and the 70s. There's the famous commercial of an Indian crying as he paddled his canoe through the messy and polluted rivers in the United States. And that wasn't even an Indian, by the way. It was an Italian actor. But I mean, that is the connection, and to bring it back to my book, The Shoe Boy, the connection that the hunters and trappers have to the land is an important connection. And mm-hmm. but what's also incredibly important was and is their ability to self-determine. The hunters, Robbie Matthews Sr. was very much and is very much a master of his own domain, if you want to use that language. He considered himself to be the authority on his trap line and his territory. And so part of nationhood, when we think of Indigenous nationhood in 2017, means having the power and the ability to make decisions which will allow our nations to continue. And so I think, you know, again, sometimes those require business and economic decisions to create a sustainable nation in the future, to put food on the tables of our children, and that's a balancing act.
Mm-hmm. And then, so your novel, is it primarily about you discovering your own indigenous identity, or it's nonfiction, right?
It's nonfiction.
Yes.
Like I said, it recounts the 5 months that I spent with the Cree. It is very much from my perspective, mm-hmm. and I do my best to honor Robbie and his family, and I certainly sought out their approval, if you will, which is unusual for me as a journalist. That would be against journalistic standards and practices to run a draft version of my script past someone before it went on the CBC. But for me, as being an Indigenous journalist in particular, it was important that I had their full consent in terms of sharing this story publicly with people. And so I was really honored that Robbie and his family gave me their blessing to tell this story. It is very much from my perspective. I'm sure Bruce and Adrian and Randy all had their own different perspectives about being out in the bush. But I just feel very, very lucky to have had this gift of spending time out there with them. And even though I don't return back to James Bay very often, it's not my home. I'm Anishinaabe, Ontario. Southern Ontario is my home territory, and it's where I go back to. So I don't get back to James Bay very often. But the teachings that Robbie and his family shared with me are very much part of me and will for the rest of my life.
Through those experiences, what was the process like in reclaiming yourself and your identity?
Reclaiming? I wouldn't say that I ever went... I wouldn't say that it was a reclaiming mm-hmm. process.
Okay.
I grew up in a household where I was taught to be proud of my Anishinaabe identity. So I knew very much that who I was as an Indigenous person. I was an urban Indian, though.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt about that. Well, I had, you know, my dad and I went out on canoe trips. I went fishing with my father. I grew up in Southern Ontario, which has been... and so my connection to the land and traditional hunting practices and lifestyles, mm-hmm. that was certainly something that I hadn't been exposed to.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that I would call it reclaiming as much as expanding my knowledge of who I was as an Indian.
So then how was it expanding your knowledge?
Well, it was eye-opening in a lot of ways because what I began to see when I began to learn how to hunt properly, how to trap properly, how to respect the animals. I began to see the many facets of Indigenous life today. So whether it's respect for elders, mm-hmm. Notions of Indian time, whether it's the importance of extended family, all of these things which are part of Indigenous cultural life. Mm-hmm. In the 21st century, they're very much part wherever, whether it's in Vancouver or Edmonton or up in Gwich'in Territory, those things are pretty constant. Respect mm-hmm. for elders and extended family, all of those things trace back to the importance of our life on the land. And when I began to see how those land-based practices had influenced our contemporary culture as Indigenous people, mm-hmm. just made me even stronger as an Indigenous person.
That's really neat. How do all of those things tie into your career then as a journalist?
The way I end the book is talking about what I ended up being was a journalist.
Yeah.
You know, Robbie was teaching me to be a hunter. Mm-hmm. I ended up in kind of a world that some might see as being completely antithetical to that. You know, it's a fast-paced, multimedia world that's on the latest technology with breaking news and some might think of that being as antithetical to that hunting and trapping culture that I was writing about. But as I thought about it, I tried to think of some of the lessons that Robbie and his family gave me as training me to be a hunter of stories. And I think that I do go out in a way and I track and look for story in the same way that Robbie and his family track and and hunt for animals. And I try to pay my respect to Story in the same way that that Robbie and his family pay respects to animals, because I do think that Story is essential to our life. Mm-hmm. In the same way that the animals and the plants nurture us, stories nurture us. And so I've been incredibly privileged to have had a career where I can tell stories and help educate and nurture people. And I treat my role as a journalist to try to be as respectful to those stories as I can be. And it goes back to that those teachings that I got as a teenager.
What is it like being an Indigenous person in a white dominated company like CBC?
It's been a challenge. I won't hide that. I when I first came to the CBC Vancouver newsroom, I was one of only two Indigenous people and the only Indigenous reporter. I had an agenda, if you want to call it that, and it was to get as many Indigenous stories on the air. I grew up watching the CBC, listening to the CBC, and I didn't see Indigenous people on the television or hear them on our airwaves very often. Jesse on the Beachcombers was the first kind of real Indian that I saw. Otherwise, it was you know, Tonto. And so much of those stereotypes and myths that we all have, Indigenous and non-Indigenous people have, about what Indians look like, what Indians sound like, how Indians act, comes from those pop media representations of Indigenous people. So my agenda was to get as many Indigenous stories into our news every day as I could. And that was a challenging... There were senior producers in my newsroom who didn't have the same notions of what made news as I did. They asked the simple question, why do I care about moldy houses in the community of Ahouset? Why do I care that there's another community in Fort St. James that is experiencing 3 youth suicides? When I tried to pitch those stories, sometimes I hit roadblocks, and that was frustrating and it was discouraging. And so I had an up and down, I had peaks and valleys in early days of my career at CBC, but I also had some real incredible supporters, senior producers who believed in the value of the work that I did, who supported me in the way that I wanted to try to tell Indigenous story from an Indigenous perspective. And so, I 20 years later, I'm still at the CBC, so they've treated me pretty well. And I have to say that things at the CBC, I feel like are starting to change from when I first broke into the business. When we created CBC Indigenous 4 years ago, as a online platform to tell Indigenous news across this country, It's been incredible success. We had to lobby long and hard for it, and that was frustrating. But the public broadcaster has a duty to tell and to break through and tell more Indigenous stories. We know that Indigenous people are underrepresented in the mainstream news. And I like to think that CBC Indigenous is a start is really starting to lead the way in terms of making a change in that, and we're seeing more and more Indigenous stories being represented in our newscasts.
That's fantastic news. I really like that. And then, do you have any advice for young Indigenous journalists or aspiring journalists?
I do. Please, please get into the business, because I have found it to be a joy to be able to tell other people's stories. I mean, that's the joy, is that I've gone and paddled with First Nations people in ocean going canoes. I've watched a boxer who ended up in prison, ended up part of a gang and ended up in prison and lost his belt, come back and get, become the Canadian middle heavyweight champion again. I have sat down with aunties who are mourning the loss of their niece on a highway in northern BC. I have sat with young boys who are learning how to make a drum for the first time. I've just been so privileged to have the stories could just go on and on and on of the people that have opened up and let me into their lives just because I asked them to tell me their story. And then they trusted me enough to share that story with Canadians and people around the world. So for me, journalism has just been an absolute blessing and a privilege to be a part of. And so I would encourage young Indigenous people who are considering the business to take it up. It can be a fantastic career. There's no question that journalism in 2017 is a challenging one to take on. The business is changing dramatically. The internet is really had an impact on how journalists get paid for what they do. The very valuable skill of going out and verifying facts and telling people news has become less valued in an internet age, and we need to figure out the models of how we're going to make money to get paid to do what we do. So that's the challenging aspect of it. But then on the other hand, there are so many opportunities now in terms of whether it's podcasting or whether it's blogging, or there's so many different vehicles for young journalists to find their voice. So it's both a real challenge but also a real exciting time for journalism. So I hope that more Indigenous people get into it, because there's no question we're underrepresented in mainstream Canadian newsrooms. And there's no question that our communities need to have strong, whether it's radio stations or online blogs, we need to have people who are telling stories and who are sharing news locally as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for making time for Unseated Airwaves. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
No, I'm really honored that you guys asked me to come in, because I got my start as a student journalist writing for, I went to the University of King's College in Halifax, and I became the publisher of the King's student newspaper, The Watch. And I just, the wonderful thing about student journalism is that you're doing it because you love it. And that I'm really pleased to just be part of it and be on CITR today. And Jimmy Gwitch, thanks very much for having me.
It was late in May, maybe it was June. Laying in the grassy sky like maroon. And I was in charge of everything you told me I should be. Exercising, philosophizing, sober. Oh, dear Louis.
So you're a member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts in Hastings Sunrise at
Beat Street Records, Bomber Brewing, Community Vintage and Thrift, Community Thrift and Vintage, Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios, Red Cat Records, and Selectors Records. Discorder's Shindig is back for the 34th year and is hosted at Hastings Mill Brewing Company, formerly known as Pat's Pub, every Tuesday night. We've curated a spicy roster of local musicians, and there are 27 bands, 27 winners, but someone has to take home the Shindig Windig crown from last year's champ, Little Sprout.
Come watch bands jam out, have fun, and battle it out for some rad prizes provided by our sponsors.
Sarah Fox Postering,
Nimbus Recording, Cannery Brewery,
Pandora's Box,
Vader Master Studios, Rain City Recorders,
Mint Records,
Music Waste, Live from Thunderbird Radio Hell,
Six Cent Press,
Blue Light Studios, Hastings Mill Brewery,
Print.
So come out to Pat's Pub December 5th for the CITR and Discorder Holiday Night with the Afrolution, Damn It Samantha, and Duck.
You just heard Oh Dear Louie by Samantha Crane. And for the second half of the show today, we are going to have a few collective members here to discuss Indigenous identity and all that good stuff. We're going to have a roundtable discussion about being Native and not being Native enough. You might find this topic, it's pretty close to home to you, so feel free to listen or to not. We were going to have a roundtable discussion, but as it turns out, we had a few no-shows, so... Autumn, it is you and I.
It's Josh and I for the win.
I think a good way to start this discussion off is an on-air confession. I'm actually a white man. As it turns out, no one on the radio can tell that you're white. So I do have I'm a Cree person. I'm from Attawapiskat originally. But I am very white coated. I think is and white passing as white and white coated are two terms that have a certain history and all that. But I think that is maybe one of the more important things about identity to me is recognizing that as I'm walking around in Canada, that is how I'm perceived as a white guy, especially. And while being a Cree person is also like a huge part of who I am, that only comes out after somebody has either gotten to know me or has like heard my name
or listened to you on the radio
but yeah, so that is it's an odd thing.
Yeah.
So how do you reconcile that? I guess if we can use that word as well.
I don't know. For me, like, people, they assume that I'm not white, but then they assume that I'm from like a white country, like I'm a tanned person, like I'm from Greece or I'm from Italy or like Spain, and it's not the case, but also like Indigenous in Canada looks so diverse. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to know, like, I'm Gwich'in and I have a very Gwich'in look to me, and people only know that if they know what the Gwich'in look like, but the Gwich'in aren't super famous, I suppose, in Canada. Yeah, how do you do that, Josh?
The whole you don't look Native thing comes up a lot.
Yeah,
certainly. And I say that with a lot of scare quotes around it. there is a thing about claiming a marginalized identity as a white coded person, I think. Mm-hmm. Like that, especially lately, I think more and more people who have like a very, very tenuous claim on like to an Indigenous community are officially like in stats. Like for like stats, can surveys and stuff are claiming that they're Indigenous or Métis, and so that's increasingly becoming a problem of like actual significance to just like a numbers issue,
mm-hmm.
Where people with no connection to community and whatsoever are claiming to be Indigenous.
Yeah.
But I think where it comes to me personally is also like, you know, the way you look is not primarily the way that that Indigenous communities define identity. And I'm also wary that though that that approach to identity politics is like pretty self-serving for me.
Yeah.
In terms of, well, you know, it means I'm included.
Yeah.
And all that. But, yeah, I've also noticed that sometimes I've fallen into the trap, not really a trap, but like, actually it is a trap, I guess, where I think that because I have status, I have a certificate of Indian status, and I have a last name that is anglicized Cree, like Keoki stems from like Keoke, meaning going home or coming home or visiting, depending on what part of Cree territory you're in.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I think, oh, that none of that can be taken away, despite the fact that all of those things have been taken away before by the colonial government. It's
a Canadian nation state.
Yeah. So the personal identity is a kind of a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. For me, something that also had to reconcile with a lot, I suppose, was not growing up on the res. Or, like, not living where my people have lived, because I grew up on Treaty 6, but I am from Treaty 11. But then there were lots of people who were like, well, like, what res are you from? And it's different up there, because, like, it technically is a res, but it's just kind of like a community where everybody lives there. It's not like there's this strict divide of, like, the res and then the city. It's like the city is the res, and Inuvik was also made by the colonial government. So it's a strange thing for me.
Oh, you lived in Inuvik?
No, I didn't. Oh. But I know lots of people from up there who specifically have studied it, like studied the residential school system and what that has done. And it's really interesting to learn about it. And my mom grew up in Inuvik for lots of her childhood.
Yeah, I briefly spent time in Iqaluit when I was very young. So I was like, oh.
That's where my mom's from.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Also, I think another one. Another thing that comes out, like we saw a play earlier that's called Only Drunks and Children Tell the Truth, written by Drew Hayden Taylor. He wrote it earlier in the 90s.
Yes, thank you to the Fire Hall for providing us with those.
Thank you very much. And we'll have more to say on that, I think, a little later.
Yes.
Sadly, the show is, there's no more showings of it currently at the Fire Hall. But anyway, one of the things that stuck out to you is how often they use the word Indian in that play. And I think for me especially, even though I have a certificate of Indian status, and I keep that as sort of like a reminder that this is how you relate to the federal government. This is your individual state relationship.
This is how you can be tokenized.
The term Indian is racialized in a way that I am most definitely not.
Yeah, I do not identify as Indian either.
And I'm very cognizant of that. And I there are certainly generations of people currently who use the word Indian and. Whether part of their personal identity or like part of their art practice or their political messaging, mm-hmm. I think, and it's still an important word to keep in our lexicon, but definitely gets again muddies the waters of identity a little bit.
Yeah.
What do you have anything else to?
I have something to say about skin tone.
Mm-hmm.
I am mixed, so I guess half breed would have been the term previously, but my skin tone's quite, it's brown, but it's also white, so it's, people define it as olive. And why is that related to food? I don't understand. Do you have any opinions about that? It's like a genuine, this is something I think about all the time.
I've never been called my tone has not been food related.
Yeah.
Maybe like vanilla pudding. Vanilla. Vanilla is maybe the closest you'll get, I think, for other people. But yeah, I don't know. Do you find that as a dehumanizing factor?
I do. I'm not. And there's also like a problem with over-sexualizing or hyper-sexualizing people who are like still kind of white, but not completely white. I don't know. And then there's also like the sexualizing indigenous people in North America and like also not being quite like brown enough to be called brown, but like not white enough to be white, and like a mess of contradictions.
Mess of contradictions could be the title of my memoir about identity. but I haven't written that, so we'll see.
Not quite yet.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people would say, oh, so you're biracial. And again, a lot of people feel the need to chime in about my own personal identity, which is an odd, which I think other, which maybe is not as much of a thing in non-Indigenous communities.
No,
I don't think that happens as much. But people say, "Oh, you're Métis because you're half Cree and half settler Canadian."
Yeah.
Or you're biracial. And for some reason, maybe it is because I look quite white, that I never identified as like biracial.
Yeah.
Is that?
I haven't identified as biracial either. I just say I'm Gwich'in because matrilineality. First of all, matrilineality tells me to. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that because, like, my mom is one of the strongest people I've ever met, and so is her mom. And Gwich'in women are just strong. Like, we have a woman chief. And so, like, I've just identified as Gwich'in. I am also German. That's where my last name comes from. But I just kind of, like, I suppose I am biracial, but I just have never really, like, I don't know my German heritage.
Right. Another weird thing for me is, my mother is from a patriarchal society. My father is from a matriarchal society. So, like, where does that leave me? I got the last name from my father. And then I just, it's hard to know on that one. It's like, just kind of got to know your roots, I think, is maybe the overall message there.
The goal.
And I think a lot of the time, the answer to some of that is like find your community. It might not be the community that your genes are from or anything, but there are urban Indigenous communities in every city in Canada. And as well, it's not unheard of to go, you know, back to your own home community to try to find out more about yourself.
That's something I've been considering a lot. I'd love to go back to Inuvik.
I remember it as being an okay place. I think I passed through there once when I was maybe 8 years old.
I went there for a conference last year, and it was really nice. It was really cold, but I think I can handle that. My Gwich'in blood will hopefully pull me through. Now we have a song by Ray Zaragoza.
Save the river, save the seas, save the mother and her family. How can you take what you want and say that we are free? If you put oil in the water, we won't sit quietly. And they were singing, stand up, stand up for what's right. Want and say you come in peace. If you don't open your eyes, how can you see? And we were cheering, stand up, stand up for what's right. Don't walk silently to the night. Take my hand and wear you.
And now we have our unseated events. Here we highlight Indigenous relevant events that you might be interested in attending. This week we only have one. We have a few others, but there isn't enough time to say them, unfortunately. I'll post them with the podcasted episode. But the one for this week is Jaundice Records is hosting a frontline benefit on Sunday, December 10th from 8 p.m. until late. It's at B-Lab. The event is in solidarity with Indigenous land defenders. This is an ongoing fundraising campaign to support the efforts of Indigenous nations reclaiming unceded traditional and ancestral territories while defending and protecting the lands and waters against illegal establishment of industry under the illegitimate crown. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to Duncan McHugh for a great interview and Josh for joining me on our roundtable discussion. We will have the rest of our unseated events posted with the podcast for today's show. We would like to thank our sponsors, NORAD Electric and Decolonizing Water. The next program you'll hear is Synchronicity. And my name is Autumn Schnell. You're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM.